Hi, and welcome to another episode of the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy. Good to have you here with us. Get a hold of me on Twitter, at Ryan Ballingy. Get a hold of Golf News Net, your favorite social media service, at the handle Golf News Net. You can download our apps for Roku TV, Amazon Fire TV, and yes, we actually have a deal in place to create a real Apple TV app coming soon. It'll probably be up in the next couple of weeks, and the show will probably be on hiatus, but it's coming soon, and we actually have it. It's going to be great. I'm very excited about that. After telling you about that app for probably the better part of a year and change, that it's coming. It really is. It's going to be great. We are going to have a great episode, and I'm really happy about this. The last couple of shows, if you listen to our last episode with Darren Bunch, who's my colleague here at Golf News Net, he covered the match for us in Las Vegas, and we had a wonderful conversation about the match, about the scene, about the fallout, about what went right, what went wrong. Please take a listen to it. It was so nice to be able to just have a conversation with Darren, to talk about golf, to talk about golf intelligently for, it took a better part of an hour, the whole thing, but the conversation between Darren and me was probably in the area of 45, 50 minutes. And so this week, I have a guest, again, great, very happy about that, and his name is Nathan Crace, and Nathan is a golf course architect. He owns a company called Watermark Media, under which his design firm sits, under which a media firm he has sits. He handles a number of publications, or has in the past. He's written a column. He wrote one in the 2000s from 01 to 09 called Lip Outs. He has a new podcast coming out that's actually out now, and the link is on our website, called the Lip Outs Podcast, which is a conversational style podcast, and it's not just with the same guests that you'll see on every other golf show, but genuinely interesting people that either Nathan knows or doesn't know all that well, but that he's going to talk to them, and they're going to have a good conversation about a variety of things in golf, not just architecture, but run the gamut. And that was what I wanted this show to be, and what this show was for many, many years. And then eventually, kind of in the 2010s, for a good chunk of it, turned into me just talking to you. And I got away from the era of the interview, which this show used to be 2 hours, and then it became 1 hour, and then it became 30 minutes. And now it's getting closer, maybe hopefully an hour again, 30 minutes to an hour, depending. But I think that the best parts of this show in its history, for the most part, were the interviews. We're talking to people, and talking to people way more interesting than me. And for so long, those interviews were maybe 15 minutes. They were treated kind of like a traditional radio segment, where we would talk for 15 minutes, go to a break, and then have another guest and keep going, or do a topic or different segment. It was treated like a radio show, not like the modern form that the podcast is. And so to have Nathan on, we recorded this interview yesterday, and we, again, ran the gamut. We talked about a variety of things in the golf course architecture world. We talked about the media world to some extent. We talked about his background. Nathan's a really interesting guy. He's working on this big project in Mississippi at a public golf course called The Refuge that opened about 20 years ago. And the people behind it are putting about $50 million into this property to get it kind of back up to where it was when it opened, and then add some to it with accommodations and things like that. And they brought him in to basically do a gut job. And we talk about that toward the tail end of the podcast, but he has been so interesting to follow on Twitter because he has showed people his work, and he's doing it on Facebook too, but he shows his work, and he explains why it's relevant, why it's interesting. And as we talk about it in the interview, so often in this myopic, tribal world of golf course architecture aficionados, whether you're a mild aficionado or you're a hardcore, and there's a gamut in a gamut, wherever you come from, it seems like so much of the discussion centers on ultimately what the finished product is, the aesthetic, what's actually there, as opposed to either what's not there, or why it was created that way, or what the limitations were, or the physical work that went into it. And I personally find all of that really interesting, because I haven't been around a whole lot of people when they're actually building a golf course. I have seen a lot of finished golf courses. And so to be able to see from Nathan in real time what he's been doing and leading in redeveloping a golf course and making things right and fixing things that went wrong, and and putting his own personal stamp on it. I find that compelling. So I'm really glad to have him on to promote his podcast a little bit too. Please take a listen to it. It's called The Lipouts Podcast. It's available on your major services. Obviously, you're probably listening through Apple's podcast app. Just look for The Lipouts Podcast. Check it out, download it, give it 5 stars, and get him rolling. But in the meantime, I want to give you this conversation that I recorded yesterday with Nathan, and hopefully you will enjoy it. But before we tell you about that, I wanted to tell you again about our friends at AutoSlash. We've been telling you a few weeks now about AutoSlash, and I'm happy to continue telling you about them because they are doing great work in making sure that your travel is a little bit easier and a little bit more affordable, particularly when it comes to car rentals. I do a lot of traveling throughout the course of the year. I will do more in 2019, already plotting it out right now. I go to destination resorts, I go to golf events, I go to golf tournaments, I go to other meetings. I travel by air pretty much exclusively to those things, and I almost always wind up renting a car instead of taking an Uber. It's just kind of how it is. And it's kind of annoying. I mean, I of course, I'm always looking for the best rate, but it is a guessing game, and you kind of have to take a chance when it comes time to book. With AutoSlash, that has all changed. AutoSlash is a free service which makes sure you get the best rate possible when you need to rent a car, even after you book. And AutoSlash saves you money in two particular ways. When you book, you're at the rental, at the car counter pickup rental, AutoSlash will search all of the available car rental providers at your specified pickup location to find you the best available rate by applying every possible discount code available to you, whether that's as a member of the public or whether that's because you're part of an organization like Costco. If you have a membership there, you can get discounts on car rentals, or AAA. I mean, they give you a discount to so much stuff. You might be able to save money on a car rental and not even know it, but AutoSlash does and will hunt for those discounts for you. Then, after you book, AutoSlash will continue to look for better rates up until the very second you pick up your car rental. Those rates can drop without warning sometimes, and AutoSlash is there to make sure you're aware of those better rates through either the rental company you chose in the first place or another offering a better rate. You can book, rebook, all of those things so you can save money up to the second that you need to get that car and those keys in your hands. In addition to saving at those pay-at-the-counter rentals, AutoSlash offers what they call slash deals for big discounts on prepaid rentals, and those are refundable up to 48 hours before picking up your car, which is huge. It's different than what you see when you go through most other travel sites, where if you pay, you're locked in and you'll never see that money again. The average AutoSlash user can expect to save approximately 30% on their rental, and that means you have more money either as a consumer traveler or as a business traveler to have a little bit more fun or save more money for your business. So try AutoSlash for yourself. It's free, quick, and easy. Head to AutoSlash.com, tell AutoSlash your location and your travel dates, as well as those potential membership discounts, and let it go to work for you. Before you know, you will have an email in your inbox with mind-blowing rates for your rental that you can then use to make your reservations. That's AutoSlash at AutoSlash.com. So once again, before we get into it, this is Nathan Crace, golf course architect, the host of the Lipouts podcast. You can find his website at halfpaintgunwilltravel.com, and you can read all of his stuff that he's mentioning in the forthcoming interview at his personal website as well. And make sure to follow him on Twitter at Lipouts. With that said, here's our interview with Nathan Crace. I'm really happy to have Nathan Crace on the show. He is so many things in golf that makes him super interesting. He is a golf course architect, member of the American Society of Golf Course Architects. He is a media maven. He is a writer. He is a prolific tweeter and does a great job of sharing his work, including what he's doing right now at the Refuge in Mississippi as part of this massive renovation of the entire property. And so I wanted to have him want to talk about a variety of things, but better than me telling it, I would rather have Nathan tell. So first, Nathan, thanks for coming on. Can you kind of give me a sense, or the listeners a sense, of everything that you're doing right now? Because you're touching a lot of different things in golf, and it gives you a unique perspective.
Sure. First of all, thanks for having me on. And I'm actually Googling Media Maven right now. I'm trying to figure out if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
It's a good
thing. We are busy, you know, and I think most of the people, I know the other ASGCA members that I talk to on a regular basis, everyone has seen an uptick as the economy has turned around the last 2 years. And we've always stayed steady, you know, even though we may not have had two or three or four new projects in the ground like we may have seen back in the 90s. But we always had a little business that kept us busy between practice facilities and greens renovations and bunker renovations and those types of things. So we've been very fortunate in that respect, and it just continues to get better.
And it's interesting you mentioned that, and I feel like maybe most people who aren't in, pardon the bad pun, but in the weeds every day in the golf course architecture world don't appreciate the variety of jobs that there actually are. We tend to think of golf course architecture from a layperson, a hacker golfer perspective, as an enormous 18-hole facility, a new end-to-end golf course, a total gut job of a property, which, I mean, frankly, you're in the midst of right now. But what percentage of the work that you've done in your portfolio has been something as simple as fixing bunkers on a hole or developing a new practice facility or something that maybe a golfer takes for granted that exists, but really can improve the golfer's experience at a facility?
Sure. If you look back at when the recession hit, the work flipped upside down almost overnight. I mean, I think there were 491 golf courses that opened the year before and 49 the year after. So I mean, that's literally a 90% cut. And a lot of people, a lot of the larger firms especially, unfortunately, had to lay people off. If you could go overseas and look for work, or a lot of people that did that. We chose not to go that route, mainly because at that time we still had small children at home, and I did not want to be on the other side of the world while that was going on. So we had a small club management company, and that kind of, that helped to right the ship through the heavy waves at the beginning of the recession. But no, it's it even today, the last new golf course that we did was Copper Mill, and that was in 2003 or 2 or 4 or somewhere in that neck of the woods. So everything since then has been some degree, whether it's a full course renovation like the Refuge, or bunker renovations, or adding tees, or looking at trees with a client. Even really for about 5 years, we did a lot of short game practice facilities, and we kind of built a little niche in that neck of the woods.
When the golf course boom really happened in the 1990s and the early 2000s and kind of fed into that Great Recession a little bit, was there a lot of thought given to what golf courses, particularly ones surrounding real estate developments, was there a lot of thought given to what they would have to do 15, 20 years down the line, basically where we are now with a lot of them, to keep them relevant, to keep them alive, and to still deliver on those promises that sold a whole lot of houses to a lot of, for a lot of developers, to a lot of people at that era?
I think everyone would have a different answer to that question. Of course, we were riding high surfing that big wave, and they were building golf courses left and right, part of the housing boom. And no, I don't think anybody knew that it would crash as hard as it did. There are a lot of golf courses that went under. There are still more courses that close and open every year. But that was a big hit, and no, I don't think anyone could foresee just how bad it was.
As you work throughout your entire career, but particularly now, maybe, do you keep that downside, that down era in mind, or do you just kind of go with the punches and take the work as it comes? I mean, I guess, is there kind of a saving, a scaling back, or whatever that business related business function is, knowing that someday there could be another recession? Maybe not that one, but one that is maybe kind of hurtful in a business sense.
I think especially the bigger name architects, the more household names probably are more aware of that. We kind of, I got into the business in the mid-90s, and we, from the get-go, even the firm that I worked for 8 years before I started this one, we always had, I want to say we were cutting costs, but we were very careful with the budgets we had. Mm-hmm. We would get $1.8 million to redo to build a new golf course. Mm-hmm. And at the time that seemed like a lot of money. And I would always laugh when I would see, and we did some good work with that, but it's a lot of work to get as much as you can out of those budgets. But I would laugh when I would see, another famous quote unquote architect say, well, this project, the owner only had $6 million to spend, so we had to be careful how we spent it. And you smash cut to today, and those dollars, just because so many people on the construction side got out of the business, and then as this the economy has started to turn around, there is a deficit of skilled labor. And so that's driving cost up. And every project that we have now, we have to factor in that additional cost, because sometimes the contractors are just too busy to do it, and you have to push the start date back.
How much, with the exit of a lot of those firms from the golf space, are there still a fair number of golf course development specific firms that can do that work, or are you pulling folks from kind of different ends of development to do some of the work you're doing right now?
Well, the golf course contractors, a lot of them sort of, I'd say kind of had to back up a little bit and punt, got into ball fields and sports complexes and that type of thing. But they had to lay people off. And, you know, when you lay off enough people, especially quality skilled labor that's been building golf courses for so long, and then all of a sudden things just turn around, you can't just go grab these people back out from the ether and stick them on a golf course project. And so that in turn drives up costs. It's all supply and demand.
In terms of the supply and demand, you mentioned budgets earlier. Are your budgets kind of still looking in that same range that you were working in the boom era, you know, plus or minus inflation to some extent? Or have they been cut, or have they kind of increased a little bit over time as you mentioned, kind of the economy has kind of rolled on toward better performance?
I think the spectrum of budgets is broader than it used to be. You know, we've got everything is a little more expensive, and some of that's cost of living and inflation and it just the way things are. But we have a number of projects that, you know, quote unquote, lower end projects where you're spending $100,000, $200,000 on a practice facility. And then on the flip side of that, you still have, you know, $3-4 million on a full course renovation, you know, budgets in that neck of the woods. So again, it's not that we're trying to do things cheap or inexpensively. It's just how you allocate those dollars to give the client the most bang for the buck and not waste it. You know, you don't see as many waterfalls being built as there used to be, and rightfully so. So we're able to focus more into, you know, greens construction, building bunkers the proper way, you know, adding extra tees like we're doing at the refuge. One of the things we're doing there is adding the longleaf tee system.
Yes.
So when we reopen, we'll have what we're calling the family tees at 4,500 yards, but you can go all the way back to 7,045 from the back tees. So that's a very wide range. And there's, you know, with six tees on each hole, there's as much or as little golf as anybody could want.
To me, I always enjoy the courses that take care of the little things. I don't really care about the ostentatious, the over the top, the facilities that really have nothing to do with golf. I'm there to play and to get on with my life. Is that something that clients have started to kind of pay more attention to now in terms of just the golf experience, and not just for the average golfer, the average person, the prototypical golfer, but like you said, kids and families and women and beginners and all kinds of people who would enjoy having a better layout for all six sets of tees, having long leaf, having a family tee box, having things that are more welcoming to a wider swath of people than the kind of cash cow golf has milked for so long.
No, I do think that's true. I think people want to put their money into the things that really matter. And I go back to the practice facilities when the recession was at its low point or high point, depending on how you're looking at it. We had, you know, again, five or six maybe short game practice facilities in the span of 4 or 5 years. And a lot of that was driven by the fact that a club said, look, we have X number of dollars. We have to put it into the golf course because the club down the street is doing something and we're all competing for these same golfers all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to put something into the golf course, but they couldn't afford to go out and redo the whole golf course. The other side of that is that people had less time. So rather than spending 4.5 hours playing golf, they could go out in the afternoon, spend an hour on the short course, meet the kids out there, and then maybe go in the club and have dinner before they go home. And so we see a lot more of these you know, high return on investment portions of the facility rather than just a kind of a blanket shotgun approach at trying to hit everything.
I want to get a sense of how you feel about modern architecture in general at this point. There's, if you're a golf Twitter Illuminati and you're in the golf course architecture discussion that happens there, or GCA, or wherever, there seems kind of this, I don't know, I feel like there's a series of cliques that you can belong to one or the other, but you can't be in all of them. And there's this idea of minimalism and maximalism, and I feel like a lot of those words and things have lost meaning. So I want to get a sense from you, if someone's actually doing the work, where you kind of see the spectrum today and where you lie on it. And if it's more than just an end-to-end spectrum, that it's a 3D spectrum, so to speak.
Right. No, I think there's there are a lot of layers there, and you're right. It does feel like, especially on social media, that you're either in this clique or in that clique, and you can't be in both, or, you know, there's no middle ground. I think I kind of step my toe in the pool in each one of those, because it depends on the site and it depends on the client. I think there's a lot of romanticism around restoring old golf courses, and you can actually go back. If all of the columns that I wrote for 8 years are in the archives at lipouts.com, and in 2007, excuse me, I wrote a column called Resurrecting Donald Ross, and it was sort of making light of this cottage group of this cottage industry of golf course architects who were channeling dead architects, and they were restoring golf courses just the way they were 100 years ago, and this is the way Donald Ross would have wanted it, this is the way McKinsey would have wanted it. And somebody found a box of old drawings in a steamer trunk from McKinsey's college roommates. It's always some kind of strange story, and that's great, and that's always a lot of fun, and it's interesting. But my point was, people like Donald Ross were true innovators. I mean, he was building golf courses when irrigation really started to become in vogue in construction, and all these different grass types and things. And my point was, if you were to go and reanimate Donald Ross, if you could exhume him and bring him back to life and show him how we maintain golf courses now and the ball and the clubs that we play with, and say, we're going to rebuild this golf course that you did 100 years ago exactly the way it was back then, he'd tell you were crazy. So there's a lot of, I mean, we used to maintain greens the way we maintain fairways today.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of romanticism that kind of gets lost in it. The other part of that is one of my favorites, when I hear somebody say, well, God created 18 holes on this piece of property, it's my job to find it. And that's great. And, you know, I'm a big God fan. Don't get me wrong. I want to be on his good side. But as Pete Dye once said, it more or less, if it was that easy, you wouldn't need a golf course architect. And so, again, I think there's a lot of romanticism on that side of the spectrum. On the other side of the spectrum, the what we'll call maximalism, even though I think you may have just coined that phrase. You know, back in the day when we were moving, you'd see people moving, you know, 500, 600, a million yards of dirt to build a golf course, and they were usually for developments or hotels or big resort golf courses and that type of thing. Those were there for the eye candy and to kind of draw people in and get them to come out there. You know, a great example of that, and I'm, you know, again, I'm not knocking either side of the spectrum, but a great example was where they just had the match with Phil and Tiger, Shadow Creek. I mean, it was literally built in the middle of nowhere at the time, and it's, for lack of a better term, an oasis out in the middle of the desert that... I'm sure the guys, you know, I don't have to name the names, you know who I'm talking about, but the ones that are on that classic side probably poo-poo that course from day one, just as the guys who are on the other side of the spectrum and gals probably, you know, poo-poo the older, the more classic looking golf courses because it's not what today's game needs. So I fall in between, and I don't really set myself firmly in one camp or the other, because each project and each client is different, and there is no one-size-fits-all approach.
I feel like there's some sense of practicality missing from the general golf course architecture debate, I guess, your conversation, whatever you want to call it. But you just expressed it, which is there are a lot of things at work that determine what goes into the end product. Budget, wishes, design style, the land, a lot's going on there. So why can't each project fit the project? It doesn't have to be a certain way. It doesn't have to have a certain ethos behind it. It will be what it will be based on a variety of factors.
Well, let me tell you why 10-year-old Nathan Crace, growing up in Indiana, decided he loved golf. Nobody in my family played. I had nobody to introduce me to the game. I stumbled across it on TV one day, actually watching the Bing Crosby Pro-Am, back when you got maybe 2 hours on Saturday and 2 hours on Sunday on CBS. And I'm watching this golf tournament. I said, wow, that is beautiful. It's right there. They're playing this game right next to the ocean. So I started to look into it a little more. And, of course, at that time, we didn't have the internet. We had encyclopedias. Mm-hmm. And so I would look into the encyclopedia and kind of ask my dad about it. And he didn't play golf, but he tried to help steer me in the right direction. Went to the library. They actually got me one of those photo-a-day calendars that you rip off. And and so I would sit there and flip through that and just became enamored with it. And then I found a copy of Jack Nicklaus's Golf My Way for a quarter at a yard sale. And talked my mom into buying it and read it cover to cover again at age 10, 11 years old and taught myself how to play because all my buddies were playing baseball. Baseball to me was boring. Now, in my defense, or in baseball's defense, I usually got stuck out in the outfield and that's pretty boring out there.
It is.
But, you know, you just stand around and it was boring. Basketball to me was more entertaining, but golf just was this new animal that I'd never seen before and every golf course is different. So, just like today, ballparks, even though Fenway and these other parks are all different, when you get right down to the core of it, they're the same. There's no golf course like any other. And it's that way because your client's different, the site's different, the end user is different. There are so many variables that go into it that it's kind of silly just to say, well, it has to be this minimalist approach or else it's no good, or we have to move a million yards of dirt or nobody's going to want to come play it. So, again, you've got to tailor each one to the task at hand.
This might seem like an odd question or an odd stretch to make, and probably is, so forgive me for saying it in advance. But is it insulting to you as a golf course architect that there's so many pockets or there's such a pocket, and I realize it's a niche, in this golf course architecture world and this golf course architecture enthusiast world that practically demands golf looks a certain way, whether it's in the form of a restoration or a renovation or a new project?
No, I don't. You know, at the core, I'm a capitalist, you know, and so you go do what the market demands. And if they want to go out to Bandon Dunes and build what they can build out there and Mike Kaiser can get people to come play, that's great. That's awesome. I would love an opportunity to do a project like that. The flip side of that is, you know, Pete Dye was doing all these great stadium golf courses and really pushing the envelope. And, you know, if you can get a client that wants you to do that, that's great too. It's tough to kind of pigeonhole yourself into one or the other because it's so dynamic and it's constantly changing.
Yeah.
But I do find a lot of times that people, especially the social media critics who want to talk about, you know, this course is too much or this course is not enough, probably have never built a golf course and don't understand that how many moving parts there are involved. I mean, it's a monumental task just getting past permitting before you even put the first shovel in the ground.
Yeah. You mentioned Pete Dye a couple of different times, quoted him, talked about his background, some of his contributions to golf course architecture. And before we did the podcast, you mentioned that you consider Bob Kupp a de facto mentor of sorts. So can you kind of paint for me when you kind of started becoming aware of this world of golf course architecture, and then who your initial influences were, and maybe how that has changed over time.
Oh, it's definitely evolved, but I still have sketches from when I was 10, 11, 12 years old, where I was sketching out holes on golf course. And it's funny because at about age 13, I sketched out an 18-hole golf course, and I went back one time just for fun and counted. I think there's like 230 bunkers on it. You know, so you know, when you're a teenager, you think about the game differently, obviously. But early influences for me, I didn't realize at the young age. I mean, I was 10, 11 years old. I built a 3-hole golf course at my parents' house because there was no place to play golf. And if I was going to learn how to play, it was going to be out there. So, no, there was no classic design. I was looking on TV, and if I saw something I liked, I would sketch it on a piece of paper and try to go out and recreate it out there. And so as I got older and started to, and my parents realized I was actually serious about it, I would get books and things on architecture, and I still have a lot of those. And I would just look at the pictures, and I would just soak it in and read as much as I could, and then really started to kind of get into the Ross and the Tillinghast and the McKenzie and their influence and Robert Trent Jones and how that kind of evolved and changed the whole business. And then I decided when I was, I don't know, 13, 14 years old, I wanted to design golf courses. So at that point it became, well, how do you do it? And I really had no clue how to go about doing it. And by my senior year, I played 4 years of varsity golf in high school. And by my senior year, it was evident I was not good enough to go play golf in college, but I still had this dream of designing golf courses. And so we got a flyer in the mail from Mississippi State University about their professional, at that time it was New Mexico State University, about their professional golf management program. And I think my mother had a friend who lived out there. And my mother said, well, you're not going to New Mexico State. That's too far away. And the only other two schools were the original one at Ferris State in Northern Michigan. And of course you can't play golf, you know, past mid-October or so up there,
right?
And the other one was in Starkville at Mississippi State University. So that's where I ended up. We went down there to visit and fell in love with it. That's where I met my wife. And part of my thinking was, well, there is no golf course architecture school, so I'm going to learn how the business of golf works and how golf courses operate from inside to outside, and maintenance and all this. And then my 17-year-old brain thought, then when I graduate, I'll go get a job working at a golf course that's either under construction or about to be renovated, and I'll tell the golf course architect what I want to do, and they'll say, well, yeah, Nathan, come on. You can come work for me. So, you know, it didn't work out exactly that way. I was actually working my senior year at Mississippi State. I was working as an assistant golf pro at Old Waverly, which was a Bob Cup design not far from Starkville, has hosted the Women's Open and will host the U.S. Women's Amateur next year, actually. And Bob came to town one day to – no, this was 94, so this was before they awarded the U.S. Open. And they wanted him to look at a few bunkers, adding a few bunkers and making a couple of changes in their bid to get this U.S. Women's Open. So I rode around in a train of golf carts with everybody else, the superintendent. You know, he knew what I wanted to do. He said, hey, look, come on, tag along with us. And so we followed him around for what felt like, oh, I don't know, an hour or two. And when we got back, Bob was talking with everyone. And as they were leaving, the superintendent's guy named Bill Colorado said, come here, I want to introduce you to him. And he said, Mr. Cup, this is Nathan Crace, and he wants to design golf courses. And Bob stood up. And he shook my hand. He said, it's a tough business to get into. Good luck. And he turned around and he walked off. I've told Bob the story before. So I left out of there like a wounded dog with my tail between my legs. And I was driving back to my apartment and I kind of had an epiphany. And I said, you know, he doesn't know me. And he doesn't know what I can do or what I want to do. So I kind of decided right there I was going to prove him wrong. And looking back, and I told Bob this, I said, you know, that was kind of the fire that I needed lit under me, because I guess I thought I was just going to graduate and send resumes and somebody would hire me, and with no previous work experience other than being around construction. And my dad was a general contractor. So I think it's the fire that I needed. And so years later, I told Bob about that and had a good laugh, and we communicated on a regular basis. And like I said, he kind of became my de facto mentor, because I didn't work for a golf course architect when I first got into the business. I worked for a guy who was a golf course superintendent who also wanted to design golf courses. And so we worked together, and we did some great work over those 8 years, but never really had a golf course architect that I could turn to. So Bob kind of became that person for me, and eventually became my lead sponsor for membership in the ASGCA.
So over the course of your career, and I think a lot of golfers who are architecture geeks are more interested in the finished product. They don't necessarily think about all the stuff that goes into making said finished product. And so it sounds like you've got a little bit of a different path to it, which I like, that you have the path of knowing how to do it and then figuring out how to make it the aesthetic your own. What have you kind of figured out along the way in the literal building of golf courses that you might not have known, you know, 25 years ago nearly 25 years ago that seemed kind of silly that you had to learn that now?
That's a good question. A lot of ASGCA members have backgrounds as landscape architects, and mm-hmm. I'm not knocking it. I mean, it's great, but I always had a very good ability from a young age to convey thoughts on paper through drawings. And I felt as though it would be more important for me to understand the inner workings of the golf business. My dad was a general contractor, so I'd always been around large scale projects. In fact, I have a picture in my office of me at age 12 with socks up to my knees. And I'm looking through a level. We're shooting grades on a lake, a renovation project that he was doing at a golf course, even though he didn't play golf. So I'd always been around. I've been very comfortable around large dirt projects. And the important thing is, you know, just being able to kind of dive in there and get your hands dirty. And I have kids, I say kids, I mean, they're college age, high school seniors and college age, email me all the time, and they say, I want to be a golf course architect. How do I do it? And I always tell them, the first thing you need to do is be prepared to go to work for a golf course contractor for 3 years and dig every ditch and put in pipe and wires and drainage and learn how it works from the ground up, because you can't just walk out there and start waving your arms around, no matter how good a player you are, and not understand how everything else impacts what you want to do on top of the ground.
How often do you hear from people, either, like you say, kids or high schoolers, college students who want to be golf course architects, or how often do you hear from people who are just architecture aficionados, geeks, people who are into the business? How often do you hear from those people? What is that volume of communication like?
It varies. It seems almost cyclical. A lot of times, kind of like golf itself, right after the Masters, it seems to spike. Everybody's been watching it on TV. Usually toward the end of the school year, you'll start getting kids asking questions. I had a high school senior that shadowed me for a few days on the renovation project at the Refuge. And, mm-hmm. and I think, that's a lot of fun. I enjoy doing things like that because I didn't have somebody in the golf business that I could go to for that when I was a kid. So I do enjoy doing that. And I think it's very eye-opening for them to be able to experience it. But it does. It seems to spike. One funny story I had was, we were redoing Ole Miss's golf course back in 2007 or 2008. And I was sitting in my office one day, the year after the work was done, and there was a knock at the door. And my office manager opened the door, and there was an older gentleman standing there. And he introduced himself and said he played golf there all the time, and he just happened to be passing through on his way to the Gulf Coast, mm-hmm. and wanted to say hello and how much he enjoyed the golf course. And so we talked for a little while, and then he got back in the car, and he and his wife drove off. And I turned to my office manager. I said, this might be the only business where the groupies are 77-year-old retired men.
Maybe so. And that probably springs perfectly into a question about podcasting, because that's the audience for podcasts, is 77-year-old white guys. But you've recently started a podcast. You've named it the Lip Outs Podcast, which is kind of consistent with the brand that you created with the column that you wrote for, what was it, 8 years in the, right, in the 2000s. And I'm always curious, especially now that there's this proliferation of the podcast as this art form, why? What made you decide to do it? And having listened to your preview episode, kind of explain the rationale for it, dig into that a little bit for someone who maybe hasn't had the experience of hearing that directly from you yet.
Sure. Well, I don't want to spoil the fun for them, so they need to go listen to the preview episode of the Lip Outs Podcast, now available on iTunes and Google Play, and it's free.
We'll link to it on the website too, so just to make it super easy.
But it was, you know, what made me decide to get into it? That's a great question, because I actually, when we first launched it, you know, say launched it, came up with the idea back in October. The idea was to call it a quick nine, and because golfers know what a quick nine is. And so the thought was, well, we'll have a 30, 40 minute podcast and I'll ask everybody nine questions. Well, ask the nine questions and we'll be done. Seemed like a great idea. Then a couple of days later, I got an email from Ron Witten, who I've gotten to know over the years at Golf Digest. And he said, look, you're going to have a hard time asking somebody nine questions and just stopping at that. You're also missing the boat if you don't call it the Lip Outs Podcast, because, you know, you've had this brand since 2001. Yeah. It's a great name, and you really, and I'm sitting there kicking myself and say, yeah, you're right. So we went back and changed everything to the Lip Outs Podcast. And so that's why a podcast? That's a great question. You know, I want to do something a little different, and the Lip Outs Podcast is more of a conversation. So if you think of again, as I mentioned in the preview, Jerry Seinfeld's Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, the idea is not a news interview where we sit down and just ask questions, but to kind of sit down with people in and around the game of golf and not just talk golf architecture, but just kind of go wherever the conversation leads and have fun with it. But the as you know, it's not necessarily a money-making venture, especially off the front end. I think it's more of a labor of love.
It is.
And I do think that you have to have a little bit of an artistic vein. And I think artistic people are naturally drawn to doing things that are creative, yeah, and fun. And I would give a plug, if I can, to the Adam Carolla show, which, you know, Adam Carolla,
it's very good.
You know, a lot of people just know him as a comedian or doing Loveline on MTV back in the 90s. But, you know, he has become this podcasting juggernaut,
yeah,
and holds, you know, world records for number of downloads and things. But if you listen to that podcast, and I wouldn't say it's a family-friendly podcast. You know, sometimes they get a little adult-oriented with some of the conversation. But if you listen to the quality of it, it's so much better than a lot of other podcasts that people have. So from the get-go, I decided we were going to invest in some time and equipment and some research to make sure that our podcast had a nice finished sound to it. You know, we have a professional voiceover artist who did the intro for us. And you look back at every person involved with the Adam Carolla show, they all have backgrounds in radio. So that's a, yeah, big difference. You know, and people who think, oh, I'll just start a podcast. Believe me, the first interview I did with Pat Jones, I was nervous because I was, you know, if I freeze up, where am I going to go? You know, what am I going to do? And so Pat was great, and that went along. And like anything else, like golf itself, the more you play, the more you do it, the better you're going to get at it, hopefully.
Not to try to make this about me, but I'll relay one quick story as podcaster to podcaster. And if the people listening appreciate it, great. But it's for you and me.
I would consider you a podcaster. I'm not quite there yet. I'm getting there, but.
But I
would love to hear your advice.
You're in the club. You're in the club. One episode, you're in the club. So I think I first did the show in 2002, I think it was. Fall 2002 or something like that. And friends of mine had started this internet streaming company. They were streaming. The company was called Broadcast Monsters. And I think now it's called All In Broadcasting. Still exists. And the goal was to stream high school, lower level college athletic games, so high school baseball, I mean, you name it, and they did it over Windows Media Player, which if you're a certain vintage, if you're at least 35 like me, then you probably know what that was. And they would stream games, and then they would do some live sports talk here and there, and they had shows for pretty much every sport, soccer, hockey, baseball, I mean, all this stuff. And I wanted to do a golf show, and my friend Scott Wasilewski, who still does hockey podcasting and NASCAR radio to this day, and I was kind of extremely jealous of him. I wanted to do something about golf, and so I kind of finagled my way into getting the 19th hole golf show, and they said, well, come in, and we'll give you 2 hours, and you can just go on for as long as you want. We'll see you then. So I'm in the basement of this house, my friend Sean Connor's house, and they gave me a mic, and they had a board, and they had all the real, legit, good radio equipment there, and they're like, all right, you're on. And I was like, what the hell am I going to talk about?
Sit down and talk for a tight 2 hours.
A real solid 2 hours. And I had done a lot of research, and I had thought of everything I thought I was going to say. And I just sat there petrified, holding a microphone in my hand for those 2 hours, wondering when this thing's going to be over and what the hell I'm going to do. And from there, it eventually became okay. You got used to it, and you made things better. People were very generous with their time, and they would come on. And I don't even think they knew what they were getting on, like what they were recording a show with at the time. I mean, some of the people, yeah, God bless them for not knowing. But it eventually spawned into something that, you know, I think I'm better than I was in 2002. I hope that I'm better than I was in 2002. But that hopefully, in the vein that you're talking about, is a show that can talk about topics in a variety of different natural ways with a lot of interesting people that ultimately isn't just question and answer, that it's a conversation between you and me and everyone listening that just goes on. And I think that based on listening to your show, that sounds like what you want to accomplish. And it sounds like so far you're accomplishing it, and you'll get to where you want to go with it.
No, I think you're right. And the reason for that is if you just zeroed in, and there are a couple of podcasts out there, and there's some very good ones that just focus on golf course architecture. The world doesn't need another golf course, even if I think I could do a better job, and I'm not saying that I do, but we don't need another golf course architecture podcast, at least not from me. And there are only so many golf fans who are dialed into podcasting, so I tried to get a wider spectrum. I've got some people coming on the show that are very interesting that are in the golf business, but I have some other people. We don't have it nailed down yet, but that people will recognize who play golf, and maybe you didn't even realize they played golf. And so I want to know how they got involved in it and the impact it's had on them. But as you know, when you are a quote unquote creative person, sometimes it's hard to just stay in your lane, and you want to kind of veer off. And when I told my wife I was going to start a podcast, she just kind of shook her head, but she understood. I mean, I've written a 440-page thriller, a novel that I'm shopping around trying to get sold and get published. Well, I would stay up to 1 or 2 at night for 3 years writing that. So, you know, what makes a otherwise sane person want to put themselves through all that? And I think it's just another creative outlet, much like golf course architecture is. And, you know, because these golf courses that I've been fortunate enough to work on will be here long after I'm gone, much like the book, hopefully, the podcast or whatever. So it's kind of something you leave a footprint behind, and your kids that, you know, they have something they can point to down the road and say, hey, granddad or dad or whoever, great granddad designed this golf course 100 years ago. And so there are not a lot of other businesses that or careers that you get that opportunity.
All right, the last thing I want to plug your Twitter account, because that's how we met. That I follow you, and I love what you do in terms of pulling back the curtain on the actual work of golf course architecture, what goes into things, what make things better, what things look different, and the challenges that you face in your project, particularly with the Refuge. So can you first of all give the plug for Twitter, and then second, kind of lay into why you decided to pull back the curtain in the way that you have?
Sure. Well, the Twitter, of course, is at Lipouts, LIPOUTS, much like the Lipouts podcast, which is at Lipouts podcast. And all that information is at lipoutspodcast.com and lipouts.com, where you can find 8 years worth of columns that I wrote every month in case you have trouble sleeping. But the Twitter account was just kind of started on a lark, I don't know, 8 years ago or however long ago that was. And it did start to evolve into sort of a business tool a little bit, but also as a way to entertain and introduce people. But especially once the refuge got up and running, because that golf course is only 45 minutes from where I live. So I'm there most days. And that's afforded me the opportunity to be very hands-on and be very involved in even minor tweaks and changes that we make, more so than on a normal job. But that golf course was a particular challenge, and that's why I wanted to give people a peek behind the curtain, as you said, because when that golf course was open, it originally opened in 1998, the conditioning was always great, but it was so tight. I mean, there were tee shots on some of those holes that made Harbortown look like St. Andrews. And there were tee shots on maybe three or four holes where the canopy of the trees were touching each other over your head.
Oh,
and
no.
And I would go out, and again, I'm not a great player. I'm single, I'll say maybe a 10 handicap when I get to play, 8 to 10, somewhere in that neck of the woods. But I would go out and play, and I could only hit driver on four holes. And that's – young golfers don't want to do that. And so the golf course found itself in this kind of strange no-man's land between being too short at 6,600 yards and too tight for better players and younger players, because there were water hazards that came out into the landing areas and just all kinds of craziness. And then too tight and difficult for higher handicappers because they lost too many balls. So when we set forward with the master plan, one of the end goals was, well, there were a number of goals. Widen all the playing corridors, not necessarily widen fairways, but widen the corridors from tree line to tree line. Get rid of the stigma of having hidden water hazards wherever we could. So we realigned and relocated a number of water hazards. Add some length and add some shortness, you know, by using the long leaf tee system. And then going in and redoing the greens and the bunkers, we created three new holes so that it used to be nine out and nine back. And now you can come back to the clubhouse after 5, 9, or 18. So, you know, let's say you only have an hour after work. You can run out there and play five holes in an hour and be back at the clubhouse and leave. So it just gives it a lot more flexibility in the golf course. Once we get into the spring and things green back up, I'm going to put some before and after photos that I think will blow your mind when you see just how tight the course used to be. I mean, it was almost unplayable in some instances. And, I mean, it really is now. It's going to be the place to play when we reopen at some point next year.
Well, I'm excited to see it coming, taking shape, getting to the end, and hopefully people will continue to follow you, or if they aren't already, follow you on Twitter, at LipOuts. And also you can check out the Refuge Renovation page on Facebook, which has a whole bunch of other videos as well. You can do that, find that on Facebook too. So, Nathan, thanks for coming on, and I really appreciate the conversation. This was a blast.
Oh, absolutely. And look, once we get the holidays out of the way, we'll return the favor and get you on the LipOuts podcast some point after the first of the year.
Well, that sounds great. Thank you again.
Thanks again to Nathan for being on the show. It was such a pleasure to have him on and get into an honest conversation that went in a variety of different directions about all of the different things he has so much great experience in, whether that's developing golf courses, that's refurbishing, renovating, restoring them, whether that's being in the media business, whether that's creating a podcast. Nathan's a really interesting guy, and I'm glad to have spent some time with him, and having recorded that, hopefully you all enjoyed it as well. Next week, we'll have one more show for the year. That'll be our last one of 2018. I think we'll take a couple of weeks off. We won't have one leading into Christmas, and we certainly won't have one Christmas week, so we will kick things back after our next episode in January 2019. We'll get you ready for the Century Tournament of Champions at that time, but before then, we'll have a show that kind of wraps a bow on 2018, and I think it's been a really good year. I mean, professional golf is in great hands. Tiger's back, of course. We've got a new dominating major superstar in Brooks Koepka. However you feel about him, he is a prolific winner at the major level at a young age, and that's a big deal. And we've got a cast of characters around those guys that are compelling, that are winning, that are interesting, and there's going to be a lot that's going to come in 2019 that should be super fun. And I can't wait to get started on it. And of course, we'll have more to talk about in the golf course architecture world. I'm sure there will be things that come up in the media world. There's just so much that you can't even expect to happen in the next year, and so much that happened this year that we didn't expect to happen. We'll talk about it all in 2019. Anyhow, if you listen to our show through Apple Podcasts or the iTunes app, please give us 5 stars. It helps us reach more people. If you can leave a review, that's even better too. With 5 stars, we'd appreciate that as well. If not, just give us a follow on Twitter. Ryan Ballingy is my follow. You can follow Golf News Net at Golf News Net. Or you can sign up for GNM Plus. It's $10 a year. It's a supporter membership for our site. It gives you access to great fantasy content and increasingly more original content that we're providing to members only, particularly in 2019. So thanks again for your support. Thanks for listening to the show. And we will talk to you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.